on a Christmas
party. Let's roll what we got then.
I have a question.
I said, I'll get the repo going. Am I okay to use a CLI? I've been spending some time actually running Express and Monkey specifically. I was having some trouble with the Unlock Cloud after an NPM install. Greg, are you familiar with what it is? Namely, the ESLint. I'm not sure Yarn. I'm not liking Yarn at all unless it's global. Or it's not liking Yarn at all unless it's global. Anyway.
There's a verse in First Timothy that talks about...
I tried just gobbling up some BS to my boss just to make him think that I was being productive this whole week. I didn't do anything.
They're really going to enjoy listening.
And they would have been stuck if they stayed in the sense.
They're really going to enjoy
it. Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Hey, for anyone listening to this recording, I'm a software engineer. It sucks.
The choice.
For now.
So, I don't think they were immortal prior to that.
I'm sorry.
Though death had an end of the picture. So, I don't know what exactly how that works out, but I still don't think they were immortal.
We're all stuck by that. It's like, so she did eat it.
I think the idea is that they were ultimately going to choose one of the other. So. No, you didn't, but we're glad you're here. Both of you.
Snap.
Nah. All right, let's jump back into Proverbs. Welcome back. Happy post-Thanksgiving break. I'm sure you've been wished that like three times now, but no. Hi. Good to have you guys back. How are we doing?
Good.
This is the time where it gets cold and dark and why did I do residency? That was a dumb idea. So anyway, it gets better. Be encouraged in like February or March. So enjoy the ride. I'm teasing, but this is always the harder season when it's cold and dark. So let's go Proverbs 12:16. We'll start there into Exodus. Hopefully, start and finish Exodus today, Lord willing.
Really?
Yeah,
that's a short book.
We started a long way ago, but finish at least. So that's
12 what?
12:16. Somebody read that when you get there.
The vexation of a fool is known at once, but the prudent ignores an insult.
All right. A fool's anger, the vexation of a fool is known at once, okay? The prudent man, on the flip side of that, is able to conceal dishonor, conceal an offense. Anybody, you guys ever been hunting? Hunters in here? Okay, a few? Kyle? Really? Mm-hmm. You haven't struck me as a hunter. With the beard, though, I should have known better, so... Absolutely. Jimmy Bitt? Anyone been deer hunting? No?
No.
How do you attract a deer? Anybody know? There's several different ways, if you're going to hunt a deer, that you would coax him to yourself. Anybody know how?
You pull it out one way.
A scent. So you're putting out a estrogen-based scent, which is basically appealing to a male deer's sex drive, right? Okay, so that's one way.
Essentially a decoy deer to deer. That's one way to seem like it's not alone.
Okay. What specifically? How do they do that?
They hold up branches and plant them. I'm just going to add them.
Genesis reference. One of the ways is you would take another male deer, you would hammer antlers together, bang antlers together, and it gives that deer the impression that there's another male in the area that's going to take over that deer's space, that turf, if you will. And they are riled to get in there, so they'll compete for area, okay? Fascinating concept, same with a fool, right? If you diss a fool, if you offend a fool, and they feel like their integrity or their honor or whatever it may be within them is in question, their response generally is what? To defend themselves, to fly off the handle in anger, to respond, okay? The Bible talks about a wise man doesn't do that. They're able to be offended and hurt and yet not respond in anger. Fascinating idea. Any of you guys that handle firearms, it's the idea of what a safety is, right? You're taking that firing mechanism and disabling it from engaging in a bullet and having an explosion go off. That's what safeties are for, right? That's what a wise man has the ability to do. Though they feel dishonored, though they feel angered, they don't have to respond in kind. So this is something sometimes that is paramount or is... known in maybe younger individuals, we tend to, as males especially, brag about how we respond and how we can fly off the handle about stuff, the opposite of what maybe God would have us to do. So what do you guys think for your trigger mechanisms, whatever they are, the things that set you off? I know what they are for guys, per se, anger and pride and those type of things can can get underneath the surface for us. Ladies, you have maybe different ones, but they are there still the same. Our sin natures are all there. What is it for you? And what are the areas that you have the tendency to want to respond in kind, respond in the flesh, and yet maybe God is calling us to conceal dishonor? The same word for conceal is used in another verse in Proverbs. I think it's 10. It's probably love. Love covers all dishonor. And it's that motivation from us as believers that allows us to be offended and to kind of swallow and say, okay, count 10, as Huck Finn said, right? And then respond appropriately as opposed to in the flesh. Okay, so one of the, again, qualities of a fool that we as believers don't want to display, learn how to put your anger or your responses on safety, if you will. All right? Thoughts on that before we head back into Exodus?
Mr. Miyagi. You should preach a whole sermon series on Proverbs.
You know, we did a deal called, this was years ago, called a soapbox series, and the whole premise was like, preach on whatever the heck you want to preach on that drives you crazy. So everybody kind of picked different stuff, and I picked like 6 Proverbs. It was fun. So just like life points. So did like a whole sermon with like 6 different messages, basically. Whatever it was. It was, yeah. Horrible way to put together a sermon. So. What did Mike say? He said like 6 different things, and I can't remember any of them. So yeah, that don't matter. No, it's the idea of, I'm sorry, the dishonor is used in the same verse. Here, the motivation is to not be the fool. In another text, it talks about the idea of love is the motivation not to respond in anger. And that's how you conceal it. But the motivation behind it is even greater. And it's the idea of love as opposed to just not responding in the way a fool would to conceal dishonor. So,
is it the idea of not responding at all or just not responding in like the way of the fool?
Here it's not responding at all. It's kind of absorbing a blow, if you will, and saying, you know what, I'm magnanimous enough as an individual that I don't need to respond in kind. I can absorb that and not feel like my honor's on the line, or if I don't respond, my manhood is less. And I'm thinking about this obviously from a guy's point of view. But it's the idea of just, okay. So now, are there times biblically when we're called to respond and deal with those things? Yes. I'm going to walk you guys through a series of Proverbs here in a bit on conflict resolution and walk through what the Bible has to say about that through kind of the book of Proverbs. Dave, by the way, is Obwald, the best that I know on that. So if you guys are ever in those type of situations where you're trying to move through conflict situations, he is amazing both in terms of the advice that he gives and the life that he lives. He is not a do as I say, not as I do type of guy. He walks that road and is amazing. So I'll share you some of the stuff he shared with us as a staff, and then a couple tidbits that I've just gleaned from the book of Proverbs as well. So there is certainly a time when you don't absorb and you respond in kind. Okay? So, shall we? Let's pray. Let's dive back into the book of Exodus. We are about halfway through in terms of the text, but yet have lots to cover today. So, let me pray. Father, thanks for today. Thanks for another day that we are assured the sun will indeed rise. We're grateful for a cool morning here in Fresno and just the reminder of your goodness to us, Lord. So as we continue to study, continue to discipline our bodies and get up early and deal with God, some heavy eyelids and some of the consequences that come and the sacrifices that we make as a result of decisions we have made, Father, would you reward those for those that are here that are pushing hard through life and jobs and seminary and papers and school and got all the responsibilities that are carried in this room. Father, would you be gracious to us as we seek to make this a season of knowing more about you, of our hearts and being more inclined towards you. Father, would you use, God, the season for that purpose? Would we walk through these 9-10 months together and come on the other side of this, Lord, loving you more, loving your son more, having a better understanding of him and in this process, God. So as we study now your tabernacle, God, your place of worship amongst the people of God, amongst the Israelites, and how you set up shop with them and commune with them and interacted with them, Father, would you teach us again this morning? We pray in Christ's name. Amen.
Amen.
All right. So we last 2 weeks ago, I guess now it's been, when we left off in the book of Exodus, we had just gotten into the Ten Commandments, to the Mosaic Law, right? So we had left Egypt about 1446 BC, by the way, is when they head out of Egypt. If you guys want a bit of a timeline. That's just a good boundary marker in terms of big picture events that happen in the Old Testament. That's one that we know fairly well, at least from a conservative viewpoint. That's the date. There's others that would argue it was maybe a couple hundred years later, but that's the conservative dating of that. They've been journeying through the wilderness, right? They've been 3 months heading out of Egypt through the Sinai Peninsula. And we find them in chapter 19, I believe it's verse 2, at the foot of Mount Sinai. Okay, so they are there, and they are going to be there for about a year. Okay, so we are not going to see the people move all the way until Numbers chapter 11. So they are parked at the foot of Mount Sinai, and all the stories that we're going to read revolve kind of around this time period. Okay. So we saw the kind of the preamble of the law in chapter 19. I walked you guys through a couple weeks ago about the purposes of the law as to why God gave it. We talked about exposing sin, protecting Israel, ultimately pointing to Jesus as the need for a redeemer. We also talked about the idea of true righteousness means obedience and not disobedience, right? That's the same argument that Paul's going to make in Romans. The true believer, someone that walks with God, isn't going to say, man, God's grace is gigantic. I can sin as much as I want, and it's always going to be covered, which is true. However, the true heart of the true believer says, man, I'm going to walk with God and honor him in all that I do, knowing that grace is indeed great, yet I'm going to walk with God as best I can. Okay, so we're in 19 and following. We see kind of that as the purpose of the law. And really, this is a new covenant. And I want you guys to think about that as we're rolling through this. Before, with the Abrahamic covenant and so forth, we've seen this one-way promise from God to his people, the I wills. I'm going to do these things. Israel's going to be this type of nation. You're going to bless those around them. This is different. This is a kind of a both and, okay? This will indeed happen, but Israel has responsibility. This is more of a partnership. They are going to be God's chosen people, but they have a choice in the matter of, do you want to be blessed or do you want to be cursed? Because if you obey me, God says, I promise these things. I will bless you. I'll bring rain. We're going to see all that in Deuteronomy, all the great things that will come from obedience. But God also says, hey, if you want to disobey and you want to walk your own way, that's up to you. You can break my covenant, and you can be sure that these things will happen. And God walks through like a couple chapters of like stuff that's like, oh gosh, hives and boils and all kinds of stuff. Like, yeah, that doesn't sound pleasant at all. But that's the nature of kind of where we're heading in this agreement. Okay, so just keep that in the back of your mind. They're going to start this covenant. They both have obligations, and it's not going to take them but maybe just a couple days to completely break this covenant the first time. And we'll look at that this morning. Okay, so 19:20, we kind of saw a smattering of some of the laws. We talked about God's word and all this. And 21 and following, we talked about the idea of a freed slave. The idea of this, the doulos is the word, the bond servant that's used in the book of Romans that Paul describes himself as frequently, a slave that willingly returns to the authority of his master. In that picture, which is we see again in the New Testament. And then kind of a smattering of laws in 22 and following about all kinds of stuff, theft, dishonesty. The overarching theme is the idea of, man, you're going to take responsibility for yourself, for your actions. You're accountable for who you are, for your property, for your animals, for your body, for everything that you do. And if you blow it, that's going to happen. But you're going to repay above and beyond if you wrong a neighbor. It really is a beautiful code to live by in some sense, that this would call Israel to a higher standard to work with themselves and obviously their neighbors around them. Okay. We're going to see more of what's in here in later books, so I'm not going to go through it in great detail, but I want to get to chapter 25, where God is now going to begin to reveal his blueprints for the tabernacle. So, again, just to be mindful of, a third of the book of Exodus is dedicated to the building of a portable tent in the wilderness. So just to think that God would care in that great of detail about this structure, it's going to become literally the focal piece of the nation of Israel. So 25 verse 1 and following, this is going to be the command from the Lord. Let's pick up there, and then we'll kind of walk through visually a bit on the tabernacle. I know I showed you guys a couple pictures last week, but I want to walk you through elements of the tabernacle that obviously will become one day the temple. Okay, so 25:1, somebody pick up there.
The Lord said to Moses, tell the Israelites to bring me an offering. You are to receive the offering for me from everyone whose heart prompts them to give.
All right, so we know this is ultimately going to be the offering for the tabernacle. So how does this thing get built, just in terms of funding? Yeah, it comes from the people, which is pretty cool. This is, if you guys have seen any building campaigns for churches, some churches are very, very convicted about, man, we're not going to take out loans. We're going to ask the people. And if people want to build a building and give, man, they do. And we're going to see at the end of the book of Exodus, Moses literally has to say, stop giving. Okay, you guys have given way more than we need. Please stop being so generous. Okay, so with all the knocks on this generation, they at least do that really well. So they come, they give of their talents. You're going to see they're going to give of their supplies, gold, fabrics, thread. I mean, all kinds of different stuff that they're going to donate. But that's the idea, that the people are going to give from their own pocketbooks and lives. And then in verse 8, the purpose of all this is to construct a sanctuary for me that I may dwell among them. Okay, so this is kind of a cool idea. God's purpose in having this tabernacle is so that he can dwell literally in the midst of his people. And that's where he's going to commune with them. He's not some guy that's on high or some God that's far away. He's going to literally dwell at the center of the camp. And I'll show you guys that here in a slide in a little bit. Okay, so that's the idea. All right. Now, look at me here if you can. I showed you guys this timeline last week a bit, I believe. You guys saw this slide. So just to give you again an overview of where we're going. 1446 is the Exodus. About a year later, they're going to build the tabernacle. That tabernacle ultimately is going to become the temple. The elements that we're going to read about today are ultimately going to be the elements that reside in the temple. Okay, David's was the guy that had the idea. Okay, says, God, I want to build you a house. We'll walk through the theology of that, whether that was a good thing or a bad thing as we get there. But he decides that God's shabby, you know, Coleman tent in the wilderness is no bueno, that he needs something nicer. So Solomon's going to build that from 966 to 946, 20 years to build the first temple, and it is insane. Off the hook, goal, I mean, just above and beyond to the nines, right? So that's Solomon, typical Solomon, okay? 586 BC, when Israel ultimately gets deported, or Judah in the south specifically, in Jerusalem, and Babylon comes in and basically wrecks shop, they're going to destroy the temple. Text in history tells us that there wasn't a stone that was left unturned. So Solomon's temple was in service basically for 360 years that he built. It gets wrecked in 586 BC as the nation gets kicked out of the land. Ezra, Nehemiah, and Zerubbabel, as you guys know, lead the returns back into the land. They're going to rebuild the wall, they're going to rebuild the people, and they're going to rebuild the temple. So the second temple is what those guys begin to build. 538 to 516 is when that's constructed. It is a shadow of what was. It says the old generation literally wept when they saw it because it was a shack compared to a mansion, right? Served the same purpose. It was great. It worked, but it was not near as ostentatious, if you will, as what Solomon had created. Okay, so that thing lasts all the way up into 20 BC to when Herod, who I told you a little bit about, he's the megalomaniac nut job that is put in charge to rule over Judea by Rome in an effort to please Rome and to please the Jews. He's kind of stuck in this really strange world. He decides he's going to do a renovation on the temple. So he keeps kind of what is, but then he builds this gigantic platform, right? So he takes this small area that the temple sat on and builds like this huge complex all around it, basically to please the Jews and ultimately to please Rome to bring in more money and what have you. Okay, so that took forever. 67 AD, he completes it, and 3 years later, the Romans come in and destroy it. Okay, so that second temple is destroyed by Rome, ultimately after Herod's improvements. Okay, show you some pictures this morning, kind of through history, that basically that wreckage sat for centuries that nobody returned to Jerusalem. Crusades and stuff were going on. Muslims come back in. They build the Dome of the Rock in that same spot. And then ultimately, that's what's going to sit there for literally 1,000 years. And then in 1967, the Jews were in a war, won back the rights to the Temple Mount via war, and then gave it away 3 days later. And we talked about all this last time, but the idea was that such a hot, protested piece of land, if they were to hang on to it, they knew that the strife and whatever that would come from that were not worth it. So they gave it back to the Muslims. So as you go into the Temple Mount today, it is Jewish controlled, but yet the Muslims are the ones that have set up shop up there, and they control all the ins and outs in terms of who gets to go up there, when, and where on all their days.
Why did Rome try to destroy it? Well, why did they destroy the temple when Herod tried to please them?
They were afraid of outbreaks from the Jews, and it was, I forget what, is it Titus that destroyed the temple, I believe, the emperor at the time. Jews rebelling and all kinds of stuff was going on. There was a group of Jews that were very anti-Rome. So there was huge amounts of tensions between the Jews and the Romans. So even in Jesus' day, and shortly after his death, Rome kind of put their thumb on Israel. And even when they had to have worship services, they had to ask Rome permission to be in the temple, for the priests to get their holy garments. All those were controlled by Rome. So it was kind of a turd move on their part, but it was a control move for sure. Okay, so just to give you a huge history of kind of this whole deal, that's a bit of the timeline. Okay, now here's what it would look like. Okay, is they set up the tabernacle in the midst of the camp. This is how it worked. Okay, so in the middle, obviously, you see the tabernacle itself, the fence around it. We'll talk about all the elements that are there inside of it, but they literally are commanded by God as to where literally they set up shop in terms of camp. In the middle of the camp is the tabernacle, and then the entire 1.5 to 3 million people camped around the tabernacle. Okay, people that were the closest were over here, Moses, Aaron, and the priest. The Kohathites and some various different groups within the tribe of Levi were closest. And then if you were the tribe of Dan, you always camped at like 12 o'clock at the temple. And if you were from Judah, you camped at 5 o'clock. Every time you met or you left camp and reset up, that's where you were. But God was always at the center of the camp. Okay, so the place of worship, the place where God would dwell and meet with his people, where the Shekinah glory, the cloud would extend over the temple, or the tabernacle rather, was always in the center of the camp. Okay, so God's super specific on how that works.
Oh, so he's in scripture. It's in scripture on where each tribe would be around the tabernacle.
10 chapters in the book of Numbers describe that, where they camp.
Crazy.
I mean, you think about, I mean, one of the Bible study method tools that you guys have learned is the idea of proportion. How much time a writer spends on something speaks to how important an issue. We have a third of the book of Exodus on that, and then you have literally 10 chapters in the book of Numbers about you camp here, you camp here, you camp here. When I blow this horn, this is how you move. I mean, it's like, good night. So this was, I mean, when you're trying to organize this many people, it can't just be, oh, wherever, right? Just park wherever you find a spot. Everybody had assigned parking spots. It's just, it's controlled chaos, if you will. So God is a God of order, and you see that in the way that he dictates the camp or whatever.
Okay? How often did they move?
We'll see. It's going to be various different things. At times a year would be between moving, and at times it'll be man overnight. So
they weren't comfortable whatsoever. You couldn't necessarily
You had no idea how to predict it. So wow. You woke up the next morning and said, is the cloud moving? Nope. Okay, we're here today. And you did that every morning. And if God left at night, you saw the fire move, you left. So, but there was no like, hey, we're going to be here 6 months, so set up shop, you know, build something more permanent. Wow. They had no idea. Okay. We'll see kind of the movements, but Numbers... on the back of Numbers 36, 38, something like that, records every stop that they make. And they basically make what equates to be like a stop a year. It's like, I think, 40-some-odd places that they actually camp in the wilderness. But they're there at different amounts of time. So, yeah, it's a roll of the dice as to what God's going to do. So can you imagine that? I mean, it's like a pretty nomadic lifestyle. And when God's ready for you to move, for whatever reason he wants, you move. So, okay? So
here's the thought.
There you go. Like Abraham. Okay, so here's the tabernacle formally. Okay, and just to give you an idea, at the top up there, that's a football field, American football field. So 100 yards or 110 with end zones. Okay, by 50, the court of the tabernacle. This area right here, this is it in comparison to that. So small overall, right? It's 150 feet long by 75 feet tall, if you will. Okay, so 150. By 75, 150 by 75. That's the externals of it, okay? So at the bottom here, you've got the entrance. This is how you would come in. Anybody know which way that faces? East, okay? The entrance always faced east, okay? Putting the elements of the Holy of Holies and that sort of stuff on the west, okay? Remember that for later, okay? So you would enter as a worshiper, if you're going to come give a sacrifice, through this eastern gate. It was one way into the temple, okay? You would come in with whatever sacrifice you had, with your lamb, your goat, your bull, whatever it may be, and there were around you slaughtering tables that the priest would use to slaughter the animal. They would then take that animal and put it on the altar with fire upon it, and I'll show you pictures of all that. That animal would be sacrificed depending on what offering you were giving, whether it was a burnt offering or we'll go through all those in the book of Leviticus, but that's what the animal would be would be burnt. There were coals underneath the altar that were taken by the priest inside for different responsibilities. You see the bronze lavern up here. This would have been like a mikveh, or a place where the priest would wash before he went in. They had to be clean. They had to go through a ceremonial process before they could worship with God, before the people could worship with God. We'll see all that in the book of Leviticus. Okay, and then you walk into kind of the more formal structure, the inner tent, if you will. And there are all these different elements inside of them. We'll kind of go through them in detail, but that's the idea. And there are basically two compartments of this area. Okay, one was the outer court in here. Only priests could go in there. So a worshiper could come in here if you were an Israelite. You were welcome in here, but only priests could go past this point. Okay, so if you were a Levite, you could go in. There were different elements in there that they were responsible for. A lampstand that was continually burning, the menorah. They had a table of showbread that was always had fresh bread on it to represent the tribes of Israel. And those were the priestly duties to make sure the lamp was continually running and so forth. And then back in here, where you see the numbers 1 and 2, is where the Ark of the Covenant would have been. Okay, only the high priest, Aaron in this case, right in the season that we're in, could go in there one time of year, one day out of the year, called the Day of Atonement. We'll study that in the book of Leviticus and look at that. But only one person, one time a year, was ever allowed to go into that room. And the punishment was death if you oopsed that one.
Is Leviticus going to coincide with Shane walking through Hebrews? Did you guys set it up that way? I don't
know. Not intentionally, but no. The Hebrews is the Old Testament. Hebrews is the New Testament Leviticus. Okay, so to be able to see those together is good. So when does Shane teach Leviticus?
No, I'm saying is she going to be teaching Hebrews alongside Leviticus?
Oh, I'm sorry, Hebrew. I'm going to teach Leviticus. How about that? I think he is teaching Hebrews. I believe so.
No worries,
I get her. Anyway, but yeah, I think we're getting there. Same time would be really cool, right? But as you guys do study that, understanding Leviticus will help you understand Hebrews.
Is there any record of a high priest ever dying in the Holy of Holies because he had done something wrong?
No, but there's all kinds of myths about it. Like, they would literally put, like, bells on him so you could hear. And he had a rope around his ankle so that if he did die, you could pull him out. Rob Bell, before he went, like, complete heretic, actually did some really cool teaching on this and talked about the extent that they would go to make sure that the priest was clean before the Day of Atonement, to make sure that there was no way that they could mess up this day. But yeah, bells, and have you heard that sermon? It's awkward for, mixed company. But anyway, it's super involved. So to my knowledge, no, but they were they took every precaution. Well, what if he does die? Okay, let's tie a rope on his foot. Well, how do we know if he's still moving? Okay, put bells on his robe, you know. So you literally heard jingle bells as he was administering to the, you know, whatever. So anyway, okay. So there you go.
What about, I know they're not allowed to touch all that stuff and go in there. What about setting it up? Was it certain group of people that had to set it up in there?
Yep.
Just the Levites?
Numbers 1 through 10, it's all about who does what. It's insane, the detail. We're going to get to all of that. But literally, Aaron, if you're a Levite and I'm a Levite, and you're from the family of Kohath, and I'm from Merari, my job and what I touched to break down the tabernacle was very different than yours. So I may have been responsible for, like, the external structure. Okay, that's the only thing I could touch. You may have been responsible for picking up the table of showbread and transporting it. But there was no mixing. There was an order to it. Each family had a responsibility. And it was only the Levites. Okay? So, fascinating. So somebody had to move the ark. Somebody had to cover the ark. I mean, it's crazy when you think about all the details involved. So, again, just a more close-up view of it. But that's kind of what it would look like. Okay? Now, it's really cool. In Israel, they actually built this. Okay? And one of the places in the book of Numbers that's mentioned, they have a life-size full replica of the tabernacle. So this is exactly, pretty much what it would have looked like if you were traveling in Israel's day. Now, they had more gold and other stuff, but in terms of size and scope, this is actually at a location in Israel where they would have camped in the midst of their Exodus journey. Okay, so it's a really cool walkthrough that you can do. I've never been, because it's like 5 hours one way and then 5 hours back, and that's your entire day. So, but
sheesh.
Other people have, and they took pictures. So, thank you. So, you get a bit of the scale. So, these are little people down here. You get an idea of just kind of the skies and
there's
scope.
There's signs all the way around the outside.
Those yeah.
Bus stuff.
Camels. These are the... Sean, those may have been the... I want to say the National Park sign. Isn't it an Ibex? I can't remember. Anyway. I'm not sure what those are. I don't think those had anything to do with
it. No, nobody can go in there?
Like, tribe.
No, you can. Today. I mean, you can walk through it. So, right? So, this is that's the idea. So, oh. There's, like, the porta-potties back there. So, the bus stops where they park. So, yeah. But you get an idea. So, here's the altar, right, that we saw earlier. The laver where the priest would have washed, and obviously the more formal part of the temple. So, if you're walking in from the east, this would have been your view. You would come in as a worshiper through this gate that's here, and this is what you're looking towards. Okay? So, cool structure, altar built up here. This would have been wrapped again in gold, shovel or a pan that the priest would have used to take whatever was being burned and the ashes that they're going to bring into the innermost parts of the sanctuary, part of one of the offerings or one of the commands that God has for the offerings. So again, close to the Holy Holies or the tabernacle itself, okay? And the first thing that's mentioned here in the book of Exodus, which we read in verse 10 in chapter 25, is the ark and the mercy seat, okay? So we'll take a look at that. But this is it. This is a recreation of what they would have built, okay? Look at chapter 25, verse 10, and let's just read about this object.
They shall construct an ark of acacia wood, 2.5 cubits long, 1.5 cubits wide, and 1.5 cubits high.
All right, so cubits, 18 inches. It's like, this is, you know, you got to do the math. It's like 23 by blah, blah, blah. It's, you know, you get an idea when there's people standing next to it, what it looks like. So, acacia wood, whatever that is. Keep reading, Alex, in 11.
You shall overlay it with gold, with pure gold. Inside and out, you shall overlay it, and you shall make a gold molding around it.
So this whole thing is made out of wood that's overlaid in pure gold, okay? Symbolic, obviously. Gold is expensive. It's expensive then. It's expensive now. It's a big deal, right? So it's there to symbolize purity and value. Okay, keep rolling.
You shall cast 4 gold rings for it and fasten them on its 4 feet, and 2 rings shall be on one side of it and 2 rings on the other side of it.
Okay, what were the rings and poles before?
Carrying.
Yeah, that's how they carry it, right? You don't touch the ark. Okay? Nobody touches the ark. And we'll see a guy that does, what happens to him later on in Scripture. But you would have slid the poles through those rings. And then, like, sorry to be graphic, but like if you're carrying a coffin, that's kind of how you did it, right? You put it on your shoulder and you would walk through one of the groups of the sub-tribes of Levi, one of the families of Levi. Their job was to cover the ark and then carry it, but that's how they did it. They didn't touch the ark. They touched the poles and the rings that went through it, okay? Made of acacia wood in verse 13. Again, verse 17, you shall make a mercy seat of pure gold, 2.5 cubits long and 1.5 cubits wide. So on top of this box, by the way, this is what is called the mercy seat. Not made of wood. Solid gold. Look at that thing. Solid gold. So on top of the lid that would cover this box that they're going to make is literally 100% gold. Okay? You shall make in verse 18 2 cherubim of gold. Make them hammered work. The 2 ends of the mercy seat. So these are angelic beings. Cherubim is the specific angel that's mentioned there that would cover their wings like this. I think they would cover their eyes as well. But they were symbolic of what's happening kind of in the midst of this. Now, verse 22, you get a picture of it. Actually, Alex, pick up in 21. Let's kind of watch with this mercy seat kind of combo how this works.
You shall put the mercy seat on the top of the ark, and in the ark you shall put the testimony which I will give to you. There I will meet with you, and from above the mercy seat, from between the 2 cherubim, which are upon the ark of the testimony, I will speak to you about all that I will give you in commandment for the sons of Israel.
All right, so this is going to be like the focal point, the most important part of this whole structure. Okay, God's presence literally will rest on top of the mercy seat, the Shekinah glory of God as it's described, and his presence as they see throughout the camp will rest on top of this. Okay, so you've got this mercy seat of pure gold, the presence of God above it. What's in the box?
God's law,
okay? Now, what happened to that law? You guys have obviously read ahead and know the story. It's broken. So the broken commandments are put in this box along with Aaron's budded staff that we're going to see in the book of Numbers, another story, and a jar of manna that's going to remind the people how God provided for them for 40 years, okay? But the symbolism in the picture is cool, right? So in this, from a Godward perspective from above, you've got God that's looking down on a broken law of the people. But in between him and this broken covenant is this pure gold mercy seat. It comes from the word kafar in Hebrew, which means to cover or to atone. So mercy seat and to atone are a very, very similar word. In the Hebrew, they both kind of have the same root. And then on top of that mercy seat, you would take the blood from the altar that was outside. The priest would come in once a year and would take blood and put it on top of this mercy seat. So in between the broken law and God was a covering, a shed blood offering for the broken law of the people. So as God looked down at the people, what he saw is like rose-colored lenses, rose-colored glasses literally, because he saw the broken law through the lens of atonement and covering. So their sin was covered, right? That's the picture that we're going to continue to see in the Old Testament as to how God deals with sin in the Old Testament. He covers it. He atones for it. How do we see God deal with it, by the way, in the New Testament? What's different? What does Jesus do with our sin? Do we need a continual sacrifice? He takes it away. Okay, he doesn't just cover it, right? So it's a picture of what Jesus does and the fact that he does atone for our sin, but our sin is removed. The problem with this system is that they had to do it every day, every week, and ultimately the one thing that they do, the Day of Atonement, they had to do that every year. So the hope in the system was that they would see, look, you need a blood offering, you need a sacrifice, but ultimately the system's kind of broken and that it never ends. It's always has to have a sinful priest that has to wash himself before he goes in to atone for the people who are also broken that need their sins atoned for, and so on and so forth. Okay, so that's the idea. So that's the ark. Okay, this would have been the Holy of Holies. So inside, so this is a group of folks, and you kind of get the idea of the scale of the innermost portion of the temple with people in it next to this area. Okay, and again, this area was off limits to everybody except for Aaron one time a year on the Day of Atonement. Okay, so these guys probably didn't make it out. They probably got burned. So there you go. Here's inside the box. That's what, you know, maybe the stuff would have looked like. So the new law that they were given, the second go-around of the temple, those aren't broken, or the commandments. Aaron's rod that buds that we see, and then obviously the jar of manna.
So was it the broken law that was put in there, or was it the second written law?
I think it's actually the second one that goes in there. Moses smashes the first, so in anger, and then makes another. So, okay? So that's the first one. The ark is kind of what's mentioned first. 23 through 30 now, in chapter 25, describes the table of showbread. Okay? What it'll look like this. Again, inside, the tent structure itself in the tabernacle, but outside of the Holy of Holies. Okay? So you got to get an idea of what that is. It's mentioned here in 23 through 29, or 30 rather, that it is a... It represents kind of the presence of God. There was a smell associated with it, right? Fresh bread every day, twice a day, they had to put in here. There are 12 pieces, which would represent what? 12 tribes of Israel, more than likely. Okay, so that's an element that's inside the tent, or the portion of the tent that's just outside of the Holy of Holies. Okay. After that, you see the lampstand. Okay, and a couple creepy dudes in the background. But that's the menorah. This would have been the presence that was always lit. So these lampstands, seven-pronged menorah or lampstand would have always been burning continually. Okay, that again is symbolic of the presence of God. Okay, more on these two home slices in a minute. But this is the priestly garb that is basically commanded in Exodus. The priests get a dress code, and it is detailed. And you see, these are the two different things that they would wear. Okay. The guy in the near ground in the white bathrobe and sash, this would have been one outfit. Explain that to you. And the guy in the back, we'll see more, is far more ornate. Okay, breastplates with these gemstones on them. I mean, it's really, really ornate. This really sweet head covering. You know, he gets a purple linen bathrobe. Way cooler than the white guy. But anyway, so these were the two outfits that they were commanded to wear for different reasons. And we'll see why. They wore certain ones at certain times, okay? So those are your two priestly creepy representatives.
How do they keep the lampstands burning all the time?
That was the job of the Levites. So with the morning sacrifice and the evening sacrifice, they would come in and make sure that the oil was renewed for those. That was an oil-based lampstand. You see the very, very top? There's like a little jar there. Those would have been filled with oil and burned, so... but those never went out, except when you were moving the tabernacle. Okay, so again, representing the presence of God. Okay, all right. A little view from the outside again. There's the altar. Again, just to give you an idea of the scope of it. Here's a guy standing next to it. Okay, You read about putting blood on the horns of the altar, where they would tie up the sacrifice. That's what it looked like. So again, just the scope and size of this whole deal, pretty impressive. Okay, for those of you guys that haven't had breakfast yet, there's some blood on the altar. Okay, there you go. Okay.
Did they decorate that? They really put like real goat's blood.
No, it's not gold. No, this is a recreation. So I don't know what they use, but no, it's obviously not real. Lest it would not be there very long.
Yeah.
Structure in the middle of nowhere. Okay. So again, this is a shot of the outer court. These are the three elements that were in there: table of showbread, the lampstand, and back here is the altar of incense. Okay. You're going to see that God has literally like a ingredient list of the perfume that they were allowed to offer. So think about this for a second. So God had this like full sensory experience. You would walk in with an animal that you could see, that you could smell, that you could hear. That animal was sacrificed. You guys ever smell burnt flesh, burnt hair? It is a very, very distinct smell. It's nasty. You will not forget it. It's very pungent. So outside you've got noises coming from a sacrificial animal, like not to be again above and beyond, but that's this is a full sensory experience. And then inside, the priests were commanded now to take from this altar the burning flesh of this animal, bring it inside to the altar of incense, where they had like this potpourri mixture that was God's and God's alone, and you would light it and burn it. So you would come inside and smell bread continually, the lamps that are burning, and you would smell this mixture of perfumes that were only for God. And when you smelled that, it was like offerings are happening right now. It's like when you go home and mom's making an apple pie or chopped chip cookies, right? You go, oh, you know, that smell brings back memories immediately. I'm told that our greatest sensory experience that's related to memory is our smell, right? So God's doing all this on purpose. And he literally says, if somebody else makes like this perfume mixture, they die. This is mine. This is how God smells. Nobody else gets to smell like that. So, I mean, literally, there's like a chapter in the book of Exodus that describes a little of this, a little of that, a little of this. You mix it like this, and you put it here, right? And nobody else gets to do it. So, again, detail and all these things that God's concerned about, okay? Now, there are high priests again, okay? We say hi to Aaron. This is Aaron the high priest, okay? He would be the only guy that wore this outfit, okay? You notice, again, how ornate this is. If you look through the text, as we're kind of moving through Exodus and kind of skipping rocks through here, we left off at the lampstand in chapter 25. In 26, you get the curtains, okay? Literally, you get 14 verses on what the curtains look like, okay? Right? The boards, all these different things. 27, the bronze altar, that would have been the altar of incense. Chapter 27, verse 1 is where that's mentioned. All this different stuff. And in 28, now, you get the priestly garments, okay? So 28, the entire chapter, on into 29, is the kind of their consecration, is all about what they wear, okay? So again, two different outfits. So what do you notice about our boys' outfits here? Make some observations for me.
He got buttons.
Yeah, he's got something on his chest, yeah. Oh. This, by the way, is what those would have been, something similar to that. How many are there? 12. What do you think those represent?
12
tribes of Israel, right? They are all precious stones. They're all different. Some people think that engraved on those stones would have been the name of the tribes that were there. But on the breastplate of the priest, when he went to go offer stuff, he's reminded that he represents not just himself, but he represents the people of God. And the sacrifice that he's making are for the people of God. So each one of those stones would have represented Dan or Naphtali or Manasseh or what have you. Okay, so that's the idea. Okay. What else do you notice? Yeah, this guy didn't have shoes on, so I don't know if that's. I guess that's part of the ordeal. So I don't know. I haven't read that. Find it in the text. Shoes or no shoes? I'm gonna go with no shoes if that's how they did it. These guys are pretty precise. So, but you get the idea, right? He's got this sash on. He's got a. This would have been a purple linen robe that he had on. Purple was expensive. The dye was hard to find, but that was the idea. This was the above and beyond offering, okay? So that was the high priest normal garb, okay? Then you had the white one that I showed you guys earlier, fairly benign and boring, but there was a purpose for that one as well.
Why didn't they wear a robe over their head?
Tell me, man, this was the pieces of it obviously are significant, but this was the garb that the priest wore to represent his job by interceding between God and the people.
Nice. So we can wear hats when we preach, because they got, I'm just playing.
Yeah, here, Aaron did.
In New City, you can, bro.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Is that the name of your plant? New City?
That, oh, really?
Oh, that's cool.
And that's what
sorry,
it's called?
Sorry about that. You were
all good. Yeah. I'll
go ahead.
Jeff,
that
oh, no.
Cool.
Okay. Love it. All right. So there you go. Breastplate. Okay. There's the altar of incense. It looks like a mini altar that's from outside, but this is where you would put the ashes from the outside altar in here with the mixture, and that would be kind of the fragrant offering. Okay. Looks like we got something burning right there in the midst of that. Okay. So those are kind of all the elements put together, right? Now, what we know is this thing lasts for hundreds of years in the wilderness, all the way up to Solomon's day, and then he decides, through David, we're going to build this, okay? We're going to take this temporary, portable structure that literally was pretty shabby, right? It's just, it's canvas and poles and what have you. There are elements of it that are super important. But when they get into the land, David realizes, man, I'm living in a cedar-lined house, which was basically to say, look, I live on like Van Ness, and God lives in like this little shanty town. Like, man, we've got to fix this. We've got to make God a nicer house. By the way, God never asked for a nicer house. David thought this would be a good idea. So he builds a temple through the hand of Solomon. Okay, so God says to David, you're a man of bloodshed. You don't get to build this, but Solomon will. So lay out the blueprints. David puts all the plans together. Solomon ultimately builds this temple. And he brings in like stuff from Lebanon, brings in trees, brings in ivory. I mean, he's like importing stuff from all over the world to make this like to the nines.
Sorry, David couldn't build it because you said what? He was a hands of...
God said he's a man of bloodshed. He was a man of war.
What about Solomon, though?
Solomon wasn't. By the time he kind of took the throne, David had put down most of the skirmishes, and they had peace on all sides during David's day. So when Solomon ends up taking the throne, he certainly has to deal with some injustices, but David spent a great portion of his life. He's a warrior. So, yeah, Solomon, not so much. So this is what kind of what they end up building, okay? Just to give you some ideas of the size and scope. All the elements are there, right? So here's our altar, but boy, that's way cooler, right? It's got stairs and, you know, it's brick and whatever. It's there. The laver's now like this sweet gold pot, right? They just, so Solomon just takes it and blings out everything, okay? I think that's actually the word in the Hebrew is bling.
MTV Cribs.
Yeah, there you go. Exactly. I mean, that was kind of their idea. So you get an idea of just, again, the scope. So here is, again, an American football field in the bottom. This is Solomon's temple here, just size-wise. And then what Herod does is he takes this footprint that would have been the actual temple, and then he does this. So this is what Solomon built here. And then Herod says, man, let's expand this. Let's make this a whole complex. And literally, when you understand how he had to do it, it was insane. The temple is built on top of a mountain, okay? So on all, a foothill, right, called Mount Moriah. But on all sides of it, there's valleys. So Herod said, that's not a problem. Let's just fill in the entire valley with dirt, okay? He's got slaves galore to do his bidding. So he fills in all these valleys with dirt to build, ultimately, this complex. This is gigantic. Gigantic. This area could have held hundreds of thousands of people up here. Okay, I forget how many football fields this is, but this is the entire city of Jerusalem. This is a city model that's in Jerusalem.
Wasn't there like a mountain that he built? Was that it? Herodian?
That's the Herodian, which is different. That's where he's buried. That's in Bethlehem. He builds his own freaking mountain. Herod is a nut job. He was so paranoid that he built like his own, he literally built his own mountain. And that's ultimately where they buried him.
How does that compare in scale and size to this?
Different. This was much more of a grander deal. Herod just, you know, built up dirt for that. And then there's like he's got a palace there that had a swimming pool. And it's pretty sweet. This is the grandest thing he built. He also built in Masada, which is a place in the desert, a fortress out there, which is insane. Insane. And visited it, to our knowledge, one time. And it's he took decades building it. So the strange thing about some of the history in Israel is you got a guy like David, who's probably one of our most well-known people. David wasn't a builder. So when he dies, he has no like statues or buildings or whatever as monuments to whatever afterwards. So we have very little evidence of David. In fact, until recently, there's a lot of people that said David's a farce because there's zero archaeological evidence of David even being around. Solomon, everywhere. Here's his temple. Here's his stuff. Herod, same thing. David, they finally, I think it was 1994, found in a dig, like some inscription of King David with his name on it. It was the first thing they had found in all of antiquity that had linked David to Jerusalem as a real king. Insane. So when you go to Israel, a lot of the stuff that's obviously preserved years and years later are buildings and stuff that you see. So much of that is Solomon and Herod as well. Okay. So just to give you, again, an idea of the scope, that's it. This would have been Solomon's temple inside, 15 stories high. So you just get an idea of how big this thing was. Gigantic, grandiose, and then Herod just made it bigger and better. Okay. This is a drawing of what the Temple Mount should look like. It doesn't look like. This is what it would have looked like in Jesus' day. Okay, so Herod's temple that was completed after Jesus died, it's 67 AD when Herod finished renovations. This is what the Temple Mount looked like then. Okay, so again, huge complex. We're looking, by the way, this is perspective from the Mount of Olives. Okay, so this is the eastern wall. Okay, this is the western wall over here. This is the southern approach to the temple. This is how you would have come in as a worshiper. You would have gone through these gates over here, and then up into the temple complex and mingled around out there on the big days of sacrifice.
Now, at this point, when all this would have been done when Christ was walking around, but it would have been like the courtyard would have been laid out, like the outside and everything.
Yeah, I mean, it's still in practice. They were still using it. Herod was just making renovations.
Adding onto it.
Yeah. So Jesus never would have seen it complete, but was working on it.
Dan and like were all the tribes at 12 and 5 o'clock and stuff?
Not during this time. So that changes, okay? And that's part of one of the unforeseen consequences of a permanent structure, okay? You obviously can see the upside, and David's heart is like, man, I can't live in luxury and God be living in poverty. Like, that doesn't make sense. So you look at David's heart and go, that makes sense. What's the downside of this? Why would God say, hey, I didn't ask for this. I asked for a tent.
Maybe he's not saying upgrade me. He's saying downgrade yourself.
Certainly could be. Okay. What was the purpose of the sanctuary?
Could be moved.
Could be moved. It was mobile. Why was that important to God?
So he can be with his people.
Because wherever his people are, he's in the center all the time. Okay. Yeah. Dwell with you. That's what he says. In fact, what's really cool, you're going to see in the text, it talks about the law, and it's written, the commandments are written on both sides of the tablets. Some would say, well, maybe he just wrote three on one side and three on the other, right? Unlikely. The idea would be, if you and I signed an agreement, right? If we signed a, just got through with a refinance, I got a stack of papers this thick, right? And I bring those home, and I put them in my special place called my safe, so when my house burns down, I don't lose important documents, right? Who else has a copy of those documents?
The bank.
The bank, right? They're quite important to them because they want to know how much money I'm going to pay them for the next 15 years, right? So they keep their copy as well in their special place so that they can say, hey, Mike, you owe us money, right? God didn't do that. God took his special copy or his copy of the covenant, and he wrote it on the back side of the commandments. So on one side was Israel's. On the other side was God's. And then what happens with God's copy of the law? The covenant. Who's it go with? It goes with the people. It goes with Moses. And it gets put in the Ark of the Covenant. The idea is that that's God's special place. So God wanted to dwell in the middle of his people. Okay. By the way, where does Israel get the idea? Where does David get the idea of we should build God a permanent house?
Probably other nations.
Other nations? Specifically other pagans that worship other gods. In houses. So it was a bit of a, oh yeah? Well, Dagon has a house that we'll read about in 2 Samuel. The fish god that the Philistines worship. David says, my God should have a house. My God has a tent. My God's better than your God, so surely my God's house should be better than your God's house. So that's why Solomon built it insane, right? So, but that doesn't necessarily equate to that's what God wanted. God allows David to build it, but that's one of the downsides of a portable structure that becomes permanent.
Why didn't God, like, make an adamant, like...
It's weird in the text. I remember, we were in Israel one year. First year I was there. And an Old Testament professor that came with us that's really, really good friends with the guy from Hume Lake that kind of led us through these, basically said, David was in sin for building the temple. And I was like...
Solomon or David?
Both. David's idea. Solomon carried it out. And I was like, the heck you say? Like, I'm sorry, what? Like, sin? Are you kidding me? He's like, yeah. He's like, read the text. And the more you look at it, the more it's like, God says no, and then it's like, yeah, or says, I think he says yes, and then says don't. But it's a little bit screwball-y. So I wouldn't go that far, but I would say, look, God spent a whole lot of time telling Moses and the people what he wanted. That's what he wanted. He never asked for this. And the intended consequences are this. I mean, it's this monstrosity. It's pretty, but that's not necessarily, it loses a lot of the function that it would have had in the wilderness, right? And God's a simple God, right? It's he's not about... Oh, so anyway,
Why it says he came to live in poverty, so that we may be rich as him.
There you go. Okay.
It's like so simple and just dwell with the broken.
Yeah. So this would have been a southwestern view. Okay. Here's the south wall. Here's the western wall. So again, if the entrance to the tabernacle was where? What side of the? Which way did it face?
East.
Okay. Same way. East is over here. The western wall is here. So as you guys read and hear about the news, the Western Wall, where the Jews go pray, the Wailing Wall, why would they go there? Why would they go, this, by the way, is the Western Wall of the temple complex. Why would they go there to pray?
The closest place to the temple.
Not just the temple, but the Holy Holies. The Holy Holies. The presence of God. This is as close as they are allowed to get to them. So that's why this wall specifically is so important to them. Okay. So when you hear about that in the news and see pictures of it, it's insane.
Do Jews still do that today?
Yes.
So nobody's allowed to go in there still?
You can go up on the mount, okay, and I'll show you what it looks like here in a second. At certain times, underneath the control of the Muslims, for pockets of time. You cannot enter their holy places. You cannot talk about God while you're up there. Our God, you can't, you can share... Muslim history. So it's fascinating. We got our guide up there teaching, and all of a sudden he's teaching us about, you know, we're just like a classroom, right? We're like this, and he's teaching us about the history of Jewish stuff, and all of a sudden he translates or starts talking about camels and Muhammad, and we're like, he's trying to realize there's like a guide walking next to us, a Muslim authority, and then he transitions after he's gone back into whatever. Like, so he's like, hey, that's going to happen. So if I start talking about Muhammad and camels, I don't know why. But yeah, they're very, very specific. And they're pretty rude. So they don't like Jews up there at all. They get vile, and you'll see the Muslim women specifically shouting at the Jews, Allah Akbar, or whatever it may be, about their God and why they don't want them out there. So you'll see dignitaries that have gone up here and caused great deals of strife. And anyway, it'll be national media when it happens. But so it's a very, very tense deal even today. But you can go. I've been to Israel 5 times and been on the Temple Mount 3 times. Because 2 of the times we went, they said, no, you can't come. Like, really? We just spent $4,000 to come to Israel, and this is my one time to go, and you're not going to let us? Nope. Okay. That's how they are. So it just depends on what kind of mood they're in and whatever. So anyway. Again, just a bit of size comparisons just so you know. This, by the way, is Ezekiel's temple. There's still another temple yet to be built. Okay, the book of Ezekiel, there's going to be a third temple that we will worship God in. It's still yet future, but you get the idea again. Football field down here, this is Solomon's temple. This is the tabernacle here. Think about that in terms of how big Herod's temple would be. This is just the inside of it. How many football fields? I mean, that's almost 3 football fields that would have fit just on the... Not even the courtyard area. This is just the holy place and the kind of the women's area outside of that. But the entire complex, there have been measurements in Josephus that said there were millions of people up on top of that at Passover in what happened on those days.
This seems like a dumb question given how much we know. But when you specifically mentioned the temple, You're not talking about the Temple Mount. You're talking about just the building on top of the mount. So we still have yet to actually build Ezekiel's temple, which will be the next one built.
Correct. Yeah.
And Herod's temple is the one that was all glorious and stuff in the pictures we see of.
Yeah, Solomon's temple, then refined by Herod. Okay. Yeah, the second temple. Okay? Mm-hmm. So there you go. Now, here's today. So if you were to go to Israel, this is what you see today. Okay? So just to give you some perspective, this is the, where are we? This is the southern wall that we saw earlier. The eastern wall over here, so the Mount of Olives is up over here where Jesus goes to pray. The western wall, again, is over here. So the temple would have been kind of over in this area. But you see a couple notable structures. This is called the Dome of the Rock. Again, a Muslim shrine. And this is the Al-Aqsa Mosque. This is the place of worship for Muslims on top of the Temple Mount. Okay, so that's their actual house of worship. So that's what, when you go to Israel today, that's what you see. Okay, there's an aerial view. So you guys are asking, does this still happen today? Yes. Okay, you see this little piece of wall right here? That's the Western Wall. Okay, you see how many people are in this area?
Oh my God.
There are thousands. Okay, and on a specific holy day, they're all trying to get to this piece of wall right here, put their hand on it, so they can pray for the shalom of the city and for the people and what have you. Okay, so that little area, the one on the right, by the way, is for women. The one on the left over here is for men. And that's where the people of Israel go to pray.
You may have answered this already in past discussions, but like, if they desire that much to be close to God in the Holy of Holies, like, why are they still so resistant to a God that can live in them? Is that because God hardened? I know you mentioned that God hardened their hearts.
Yeah.
Is that purely because of that, or
I wouldn't say they're opposed to that. They're just still waiting on the Messiah that is supposed to do that. And for them, it wasn't Jesus. And you got to understand, Jesus wasn't the first guy in Jewish history to say, "Hey, by the way, I'm the Messiah." There were dozens of those guys. In fact, there were people that said, "I can do miracles," and historically, did. Figure that one out, right? There's a couple folks in their. Their history, I'm trying to remember the names that Rona talked about, that historically people wrote about them and said, yeah, that guy claimed to be miracles, did, and claimed to be the Messiah. And turned out to be false, led a rebellion. Simon Bar-Jonah, I think, is one of them. Anyway, so it's not that they're opposed to it. They just haven't found their guy yet. And because Jesus came not as a conquering king, but as a suffering servant, he's not the right guy. So
that's crazy.
Yeah. So anyway, so that's today. So again, you talk about the hottest piece of real estate in the world. This is it. The most contested, the most energized, that's it. So you've got Muslims who think it's theirs because they came in the 600s and took it over. Muhammad, when he dies, or doesn't die, he gets, I forget what their language would be, but raptured into heaven. It says he tied his horse off at the farthest place. Al-Aqsa means farthest place. So they believe that in the entire Quran, that is their one tie to what they think is Jerusalem. It says the farthest place. And they believe that that is Jerusalem. That's the Temple Mount. This is where Muhammad ascended into heaven. So this is theirs. Okay?
Did they just build Al-Aqsa just to say, oh, that's, did they build that after the fact? Or
they built it during that time where the second temple had been destroyed, and literally this place was in rubble, and it laid in rubble for hundreds of years. Nobody wanted anything to do with it. And it just happens through the Crusades and everything else that the Muslims roll in and are like, okay, we'll rebuild. We got the money. We've conquered people. So great. So they rebuild it, build their mosque, and go, hey, Al-Aqsa, that must be here. Maybe it was France. I don't know. Right, but that's where they tie it to. So, and then if you even look today in terms of what the UN is doing, they're trying to erase all Jewish ties to this place. It's all Muslim. Like, I'm sorry, what is this built on? Like, anyway, it's fascinating. So the UN and Israel do not get along, to say the least. So anyway, that's what's there today. So one day there will be a temple built upon it. That's Ezekiel's temple. This is the location that's going to be. But as we rewind the tapes all the way to Abraham, gang, this is where Abraham sacrificed Isaac. This is Mount Moriah in this area. So this is the place where Abraham would have brought his son Isaac to be sacrificed. That place ultimately becomes the spot that David's going to purchase at the end of 1 Samuel. He buys this plot of land, decides, I'm going to build a temple here, and says, Solomon, here are the blueprints. Solomon builds it. All of that's connected. So this is Mount Moriah as well.
Wasn't Mount Moriah correct me if I'm wrong, also purchased by Abraham twice? I've heard that said almost as if it's like a double receipt kind of thing.
David does. Abraham never purchased it. He just buys Machpelah, that cave. But David purchased it. Yeah. So, yep. So, anyway. So just to give you guys an idea of the scope of what we're looking at. Okay. And again, if you look through Exodus all the way through up to chapter 32, this is just the blueprints. Okay. 32, 33, and 34 are a parentheses of like live action that we're going to look at. Okay. 35 all the way through 40 is the building. Okay. So we just walked through the blueprints, and then you get another six chapters on the actual building of this structure. Insane in terms of the amount of text that's dedicated to the building of a tabernacle. Okay. So with that in mind, I do want to cover 32 and following. So just to note kind of where we're at in the big picture. So God has given all of these instructions all about every element of the tabernacle. By the time we get to 31, we find out that in 31:18, the last verse of chapter 31, when he had finished speaking to him upon Mount Sinai, he gave Moses the two tablets of the testimony, tablets of stone written by the finger of God. Okay? Moses has been up the hill for 40 days communing with God. The people have been below at Mount Sinai, below at the foot of Mount Sinai, and they got a little panic. Where's Moses? He's been gone for a month and a half. Is he coming back? What do we do? Okay. So chapter 32 is kind of what happens during this the season when Moses is up the hill. So 32, verse 1. Somebody pick up there. What? Does that not sound like the most backwards thing? They haven't even been here a month, and Moses is gone, and what do they ask for?
An idol.
We need an idol, like we have in Egypt for the last 400 years. We need a God that will be among us, right? What's the language that they use? That will go with us and be before us, right? That we can hold and touch and see. Make us something, okay? And Aaron, being the godly leader that he says no. That's not right. That's not what we want to do. Is that what Moses or Aaron does in verse 2? Ding dong, read that.
Aaron said to them, "Tear off the gold rings which are in the ears of your wives, your sons, and your daughters, and bring them to me." Then all the people tore off the gold rings which were in their ears and brought them to Aaron.
So they all take all their like jewelry off, hand it to Aaron. Verse 4.
He took this from their hand and fashioned it with a graving tool and made it into a molten calf. And they said, "This is your God, O Israel, who brought you up from the land of Egypt."
Are you kidding me? Jeez. So Aaron like melts down the gold, fashions it into an idol, a golden calf, and says, "This is the God that delivered you from Egypt. Could you do something more offensive to God?" These were earrings an hour ago, but this is the God that brought you out of Egypt. Holy cow, right? Sorry. That was funny. Aaron saw this. He built an altar before it. And Aaron said, "Tomorrow there shall be a feast to the Lord." Okay, they don't stop there. Verse 6.
So the next day they rose early and offered burnt offerings and brought peace offerings.
By the way, what are those? Burnt offerings and peace offerings. Where do we see those things? Tabernacle. Leviticus, right? Those are offerings that God says, burn this, do this. These are godly things. We're going to see that this is part of their culture.
Weren't they like burning incense to other gods?
Keep going.
And the people sat down to eat and to drink and rose up to play.
Sat down to eat and to drink and rose up to play. So they take what is from the Lord, and then they eat and drink, which means they had food, and then they had a kegger, and they rose up to play. Anybody else have a different translation for play?
It's for
engage in revelry. Okay.
6.
Sorry to be graphic. Oh. The most appropriate English translation of that word would be orgy. Oh. This is sexual in nature. Where did they learn to worship false gods with food and drink and idolatry and this type of sexual devious interaction. Pagan nations. This is what the nations around them do. So this is what they do. Their god's gone. Their leader's gone. So we need a new god. We need a new way to worship. That seems pretty cool. Let's do that. This is how the nations around us worship. So if you're God right now, and you're giving Moses the law, and you're watching the people, what are you thinking? Dude, I am so done with them. Okay? Then the Lord, verse 7, spoke to Moses. Listen to this. Go down at once. Your people, whom you brought up from the land of Egypt, have corrupted themselves. This is God speaking to Moses. Your people, who you brought up from Egypt, have corrupted themselves. They have quickly turned aside from the way which I commanded them. They have made for themselves a molten calf. They have worshipped it, have sacrificed to it, said, this is your God, O Israel. verse 9, God says to Moses, I have seen this people. Behold, they are obstinate, right, which is true. Verse 10, now let me alone that my anger may burn against them, that I may destroy them, and I will make you a great nation. Wow. What is God's plan?
Kill.
We're going to hit the Staples reset button, right? The easy button. Over. They're done. We'll start over. Moses, it's you, and it's me, and I'll make you a great nation. We'll start over. I mean, do you see how vile this is? Like how God is, he's in the middle of giving the decree. Like he's writing down the covenant relationship that he and the people are going to have while they're having an orgy down the hill. Worshipping other gods and involved in devious sexual activity. Like, man, God's hot mad. Now, I think part of this isn't just God expressing his anger, which is righteous anger, but I think part of it is a test for Moses as a leader. Okay, what did Moses do for 40 years in the wilderness? What was his job? He was a shepherd. His role was to shepherd sheep, to take care of them. What is Moses' job now?
To shepherd
the people, right? He's a pastor. He's a shepherd. Now, how is he going to respond? Is he going to be frustrated and say, heck yeah, God, torch them all. Let's be done. They are obstinate. I don't like them, right? Which, he's been on kind of the end of their bad list for a long time. He's been frustrated. He bellyached to Jethro, right? And vomits his last year of this is what it's been like, walk through the wilderness with these clowns. Like, it's been rough. But he doesn't respond this way. I want you to look at verse 11. This is fascinating. This is what you're going to love about Moses.
Then Moses entreated the Lord his God and said, O Lord, why does your anger burn against your people whom you have brought out from the land of Egypt with great power and with a mighty hand?
All right, pause there. Make some observations. What does he say to God?
Your people that you brought.
And God said, I'm just a voice. I'm just a tool. And you're using me. I'm a nobody. These are your people. You brought them out. I held the staff. I didn't even hold that. Aaron actually did that, right? I just said stuff. These are your people, right? With what? Your power, your great hand. God, you're all of it. Like, I just show up, right? I clock in and I do what you tell me, okay? And then I clock out at the end of the day. That's my job. I've done what you've told me.
I was going to say, it's funny because God said to Moses, it's your people that you brought out. And so it does seem like it is a test.
Yeah. How tempting would it have been for Moses to say, that's right, I have done something. God, you do kind of owe me this, right? I'm kind of a big deal. I've been super patient. I've given them chance after chance after chance. They've barked about food and water and shelter and the Amalekites. We're done. God's done great. I'm done. I mean, super easy just to say no. He doesn't. And watch what he does. This is absolutely brilliant. And I think this is what the test for Moses. Keep going to 12.
Why should the Egyptians speak, saying, with evil intent he brought them out to kill them in the mountains and to destroy them from the face of the earth? Turn from your burning anger and change your mind about doing harm to your people. Remember Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, your servants to whom you swore by yourself and said to them, I will multiply your descendants as the stars of the heavens, and all this land of which I have spoken I will give to your descendants.
All right.
And they shall inherit it forever.
Sorry, Kate. So, what do you see there? What does he do with God? Where does he start with in verse 12? Who does he speak of right at the beginning of 12?
Egyptians.
The Egyptians. Why does Why does it Moses bring that up? Why is that important?
Because God has influenced them to worship like that.
Yeah. Okay. What else?
He just showed his power against the Egyptians, and the Egyptians could have killed them anytime they wanted.
So how's God going to look if he won all the battles in Egypt, and clearly all the battles in Egypt were what? What was the purpose of those? All the plagues were for one reason. I'm God, your gods are not God, right? So they get out in the wilderness, they're here for a month, and God got lost and can't get his people to the wilderness. And Moses says, what are the Egyptians going to say? You're going to be a clown. They're going to think that all of their gods are greater than you. God, your reputation is at stake, not mine. This isn't about me as a leader. This is about you as a God. Brilliant, right? God, you have to show your power and who you are. For what reason? Verse 13. Remember your promise. Remember Abraham and Isaac. You covenanted with these people. You promised to do this, God. You cannot relent. And verse 14. So the Lord changed his mind. Can God do that? Absolutely he can. So I think part of this, again, was a test for Moses to see how he would respond. I think that was God's heart from the get-go. And Moses responds well with great patience. And you're going to see he's actually going to take it a step further. This isn't all that Moses is willing to do. So verse 15, Moses has the two tablets in his hand. You see it at the end of verse 15. Tablets which were written on both sides. They were written on one side and the other. He brings them down the hill. Verse 19, Moses' anger burned. He threw the tablets from his hand. Once he sees what the people are doing, they shatter on the foot of the mountain there in verse 19. And then he calls the people together. Verse 20. Read that. This is funny. Okay, so this is odd. So they make a calf from all this jewelry, right? Melt it down, turn it into a calf. Moses takes it and does the opposite. He takes the calf which they had made, burns it into the ground, into a fine powder. Like, that would have been enough to say, okay, we've destroyed your golden calf. Then what does he do? He puts it in the water and makes him drink it. What happens after you drink something? You pee it out, right? This is a commentary on God's view of idols. This is their worth to you, ultimately. Right? It's funny. You're going to pee them out. They have zero power, right? This is God. Moses is giving them an audiovisual of the substance of what they're worshiping. This, in the end, is its value. Nothing. They go in, they go out. It's useless, okay? Moses now turns to Aaron and says, what did the people do to you that you brought such a great sin upon them? Surely they held you at gunpoint, right, is the idea. Yes, Sean.
Maybe this is off topic, but do we know what kind of effects drinking gold would have on the human body? Like, could it be painful when you're all of a sudden urinating? Like, hey, not only are we going to affect, like, your mental state, but, like, a physical state? But, like, this is painful?
I have no idea. That's a great question. I've never studied that. No idea. So, Aaron gets called to the carpet here, right? What did they do to you, Aaron, that you did this for them? 22 rather, look at his response.
Aaron said, do not let the anger of my Lord burn. You know the people yourself, that they are prone to evil.
You know, Moses, like, yeah, you know how they are. You just got to see him try to explain this away. Keep going.
For they said to me, make a God for us who will go before us. For this Moses, the man who brought us up from the land of Egypt, we do not know what has become of him. I said to them, whoever has any gold, them tear it off. So they gave it to me, and I threw it into the fire, and out came this calf.
Isn't that great? Does that not sound like a three-year-old with their hand in the cookie jar, all over their face, with chocolate chip cookies? They're like, I don't know. It just was in my mouth. Like, he's caught red-handed, and it's like, ah, pop this calf. Like, I think you're missing some steps in that process of you molding it and fashioning it into a cow, right? So Moses saw that the people were out of control, 25. He tells Aaron and says, let them not be a derision for their enemies. And 26, watch what he does. Moses stood at the gate of the camp and said, whoever is for the Lord, come to me. Whoever hasn't participated in this, whoever's on team Aaron and team God still, come over here. And all the sons of Levi gather to him. So the idea is none of the Levites have participated in this grotesque worship service, okay? 27, he said to them, "Thus says the Lord, the God of Israel, every man of you put his sword against his thigh, go back and forth from the gate of the camp, and kill every man his brother, every man his friend, every man his neighbor." If there is a male that has participated in this, I don't care if he's your neighbor, if he's your friend, I don't care if he's your brother, kill him.
That's crazy.
Wow.
Didn't Moses just tell God to spare?
He does spare many. Look at how many males die, verse 28. 3,000 men of the people fell that day. It's interesting that God holds the men responsible for this, right? Women don't die today. It's the men who are leading the charge in this.
Thing that I find interesting is that God didn't specifically say to do that.
To do what?
To go through and kill all the people that did it.
Yeah, the verse before. Oh, yeah.
I thought that he was convinced by Moses to not do that.
He's going
to
spare not killing all 3 million of them.
God, okay.
He's going to take into account the 3,000 apparently men that were intimately involved in this. Okay. That makes sense?
All 3 million, you said?
Yeah, he spares the entire congregation, but punishes the guilty. Okay. Yeah.
He says, like, kill your brother, he was involved, but Moses doesn't kill Aaron.
Aaron gets a big, fat, heaping teaspoonful of grace on this one.
So Moses knows, but, like, specifically doesn't.
I don't think Aaron was involved in the immorality. He was obviously involved in the making of the golden calf. Aaron gets grace on this one. And he's going to continue to lead the people. So it seems like he gets right with the Lord again. But yeah, he blows this big time.
Imagine the guilt that he's living with.
Yeah. So I think honestly, had he been involved in the immorality side, he would have died as well. It looks like he's not. So we've got, again, a million or up grown over 20 men, like over 20 years old, right? 3,000 die. So big perspective, we're like less than 1%. 3,000 people dying in a day is gigantic, right? This is a big deal, okay? Now, here's where Moses gets capital A.
Isn't that
awesome?
I heard this parallel, sorry, between that and Acts, of how many people come to the Lord.
Oh, get saved on the first day?
Yeah.
3,000 men are added to the number, Acts 2. Pentecost, or is it 5,000?
It's 3, isn't it? And then 2.
It's 3.
I don't know. You guys are
three.
Taking the test. All right.
I think it's 3 and then 2.
I think you're right. 5,000.
I might need some blame for that one.
I'm taking that one already. Okay. Now, watch this. Verse 30 now. Pick up. This is really cool.
On the next day, Moses said to the people, "You yourselves have committed a great sin, and now I am going up to the Lord. Perhaps I can make atonement for yourself."
All right, so just because you didn't die in the 3,000, all y'all have committed a sin, right? I'm going to go to the Lord, and I'm going to see if I can intercede on your behalf so that God doesn't kill the rest of you, okay? I'm going to make atonement for your sin, okay? Keep going.
Then Moses returned to the Lord and said, "Alas, this people has committed a great sin, and they have made a god of gold for themselves."
Okay, so the people that weren't involved in the morality, they were all guilty of this. So Moses doesn't excuse it. He doesn't say, "God, it's not a big deal. Hey, we took care of the other 3,000 yesterday." He says, no, all of them are guilty. Watch 30. "I'm going to make atonement for your sin." 32, this is how Moses plans to do it.
"But now, if you will, forgive their sin, and if not, please blot me out from your book, which you have written."
What in the world does that mean?
To erase.
Forgive their sin. And if you can't forgive it, then take me. Take me out of the book of life, eternity, spent with you, God, and I will be a substitutionary atonement for these people that have sinned. Does Moses get it? He gets it. Would you do this for these people that have been obstinate, have been in your face and said, "This is your fault. Where's our water? Where's our food? Where's our water? We don't like you. A little more than I'm gonna get stoned," is what he says to Jethro. Like, these people don't like Moses. They're not even on friendly terms, right? And he says, "I will lay down my life for all y'all, if that's what it takes, Lord."
So, because Aaron sinned in that respect, is Aaron not a part of the book of life? Because Is he sin so it's blotted out and something can be one of those stand before God and say, oh, I did all this for you, but he said depart from me?
I think we'll see Aaron in heaven. I think he gets right. I think part of the reality of this priesthood is that they're all sinners. And Moses has to show Aaron even that. Look, man, you're not above this. So I think he gets the same grace that everybody else does, maybe a little bit more so. So yeah, I think he's good, but it is interesting that Aaron's sin is pretty grievous. And God says, I can forgive that as well. But this to me is the greatest moment in Moses' life. This is amazing. Given what he's been through, he gets it. So amazing stuff, okay? The Lord says to Moses now in verse 34, go, lead your people where I will tell you. Behold, my angel shall go before you. Nevertheless, in the day when I punish, I will punish their sin. And God basically says in verse 3 of chapter 33, I will not go up in their midst because you are an obstinate people that I might destroy you. I was going to walk with you through the wilderness, but I'm so hacked, I'm done. If I went with you, I would kill you all. So God's saying, okay, I'll forgive them, but I'm not going with you. I'll send an angel, but I'm not going. And Moses says, that ain't going to work either, God. So he goes to God and says in verse 12 of chapter 33, bring up this people, but you yourself say, you've told me to bring them up, but you're going to say, I'm not going to go with you. I have known you by name. I have found favor in your sight. Verse 13, now therefore I pray, God, if I have found favor in your sight, let me know your ways that I may know you, so that I may find favor in your sight. Consider, too, this nation is your people. God, you have to come with us, is what he's saying. We're not taking an angel. Either we're parking it here, or you're going with us, but we're not going with an angel. 14, God says, my presence shall go with you. I will give you rest. Again, I think he's pushing on Moses. Do you understand our relationship? Do you understand the covenant? I think God wants to go, but he's making sure that Moses understands the sacrifice involved and the significance of the covenant they've made. And he says, if your presence does not go up with us in verse 15, do not lead us up from here. I don't want to go with some B-team angel. I want God or nothing, which is pretty amazing that they have this type of relationship. And in 17 and following, God says, or Moses says to God, man, I want to see you. I want to know you. I want to see your face. And this is the text where we see literally in chapter 33, verse 23, the last verse, that God basically puts Moses in the cleft of a rock up in this wilderness area somewhere and passes by and shows Moses his back. It's like he's leaving. Really, really kind of cool picture of this relationship that they have. Okay, in 34 and following, they renew this covenant. God says, okay, I don't have to renew it. I was in the middle of drafting it, and y'all broke it. But because I love you, I'm not going to kill you all. We're going to punish the guilty. I'm not going to kill all of you. And we're going to renegotiate this covenant. I will re-enter it with you because I'm a gracious God. Okay, look at verse 6. This is one of the coolest descriptions of God. And this is an autobiographical picture of God. Chapter 34, verse 6. Sorry, there's a lot of stuff that is recovering of law and stuff, so you're not missing anything that we're not going to cover somewhere else, okay? 34:6 rather is really cool. This is God speaking of his own character. Read that.
Then the Lord passed by in front of him. And proclaimed, the Lord God, compassionate and gracious, slow to anger and abounding in loving kindness and truth, who keeps loving kindness for thousands, who forgives iniquity, transgression, and sin.
All right, pause right there. This is God's self-description of himself. Is that not amazing? Compassionate, gracious, slow to anger, abounding in loving kindness, has said in truth, who keeps loving kindness for thousands, who forgives iniquity and sins and transgressions. I mean, that's an amazing description of God, right? And that is his self-description. However, is there a flip side of that? Is he all grace? Is he all love? And no other side of that. No. Yet, by no means will leave the guilty unpunished, visiting the iniquity of fathers on their children and grandchildren to the third and fourth generations. God says, I will deal with sin. And when there's sin in the camp, I'll deal with it. And the idea of this text, by the way, some have taught generational sin out of this text. I don't think that's what it's saying. God's not punishing me because my biological father was an alcoholic. I'm not going to punish my kids 3 and 4 generations later. I think he's saying, I extend loving kindness and grace to thousands, i.e. thousands of generations, and you're going to see the ramifications of sin in generations that follow as well to the third and fourth generation, right? So does my parents' sin, my biological father's sin, affect me? Absolutely. Does my poor decision-making at times affect my kids? And they're absolutely. So we can see the ramifications of
it. So what does it mean when somebody says, because I hear a lot of like scholars, people want to read, and says that each of us have a sin that we inherited. So it's not talking about from our fathers, talking about from more of Adam and Eve.
There's a sin nature that we inherited for sure from Adam and Eve. That's theological. The sin that we inherit could be the consequences of that, right? One could argue that I have a tendency towards alcoholism because my biological father was an alcoholic. So that may be a sin that I inherited. I may have to be more aware of that than you do, if that's not a part of your family history or what have you. So that would be an example.
Could it be speaking to traits and saying that this faith and love and all of this will be found in my people for generations, if it's found in one person, that this sin may take a generation or four to get almost bred out of them, in a way?
Yeah, I think in a sense. I think the comparison is thousands, verse 3 and 4, when God's describing his character, he is saying, I am by and large gracious and compassionate, and for that is who I am. However, I don't excuse sin. I don't just look over it and say it's no big deal. So there's a balance. There's a flip side of that coin. God prefers grace and compassion, as we just saw. He just saved a generation who he didn't have to, and has a really, really, really long fuse. Thank God. Okay, so that's chapter 34, the renewal of the covenant. We'll look maybe at pieces of that here a bit tomorrow as we get into Leviticus. Hooray! But 35 and following is, hey, the blueprints that I gave you, build them. Now they're going to build the tabernacle. We'll look at that tomorrow as well as we get into Leviticus. So read ahead. See you guys bright and early in the manana, and we will study a bit of this and get into the book of Leviticus.